Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As much of the world is tearing itself apart with division and polarization, is there anything we can do to try and build an alternative political culture? During the Great Depression, a wily, iconoclastic man called Saul Alinsky said, yes, as he began building bridges between religious organizations and unions in the Back of the Yards community in southwest Chicago. That organization sought to build connections between communities and workers to achieve greater justice for them both. Today, the organization he founded, the Industrial Areas Foundation, is in 84 cities around the world. And in each of those places, dotted across the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, Europe, Hong Kong, Australia, and New Zealand, the movement is building a political culture based on relationships and action for the common good. Today's Changemaker Chat is with one of the most experienced organizers in that movement. We are speaking with Arnie Graf. Arnie was trained by Alinsky, who was hilariously formative in Arnie's development, and he talks about that in the interview. Arnie shares some of the stories of his organizing across places like Baltimore, San Antonio, and South Africa. He also shares the triumphs and tribulations of how he sought to translate organizing into a political party context with the Labour Party in the United Kingdom. And full disclosure, relationship-based community organizing is my primary way of being in the world. My training with the Industrial Areas Foundation in 2006 saw me return to Australia and build the Sydney Alliance. I love this stuff. After 10 years as a lead organizer, I also think about how it can change and evolve. But I want to be upfront about where I'm coming from. So, let's go. I'm Amanda Tattersall. Welcome to Changemaker Chats, conversations with people changing the world. Changemakers also produces episodes that are feature stories about social change campaigns. Changemakers is supported by the Sydney Policy Lab at the University of Sydney. They break down barriers between researchers, policymakers, and community campaigners so we can build change together. Check them out at sydney.edu.au/policy-lab. Changemakers also runs an organising school where you can sharpen your skills to make change in the world. All the details are on our website, where you can also sign up to our email list. It's changemakerspodcast.org. Cool. So, Arnie, welcome to Changemaker Chats.
Thank you.
It's delightful to have you with us across many seas and amidst such difficult times. We are really excited to have you on because I know your work well, and it is about embodying a distinctive approach to making change. And I was hoping that you could start the conversation by telling our listeners about the distinctive take and approach that you have applied to making change in the world.
Well, I like the word patient. There's a book about the civil rights movement in our country, and the chapter is about a man named Robert Moses, and the name of the chapter is Organizing-Slow-Respectful-Work. My life has been in building organizations where there were no broad-based organizations of our type, and it usually took between 2 and 3 years before we actually founded the organization and went public. And in the period of time from just beginning to the founding meeting, there were, I and others, leaders that I would meet, did literally well over 1,000 individual relational meetings. And those meetings, that means they are two people face-to-face, exploring their interests and their story. And from there, you know, we bring people together in small groups. And that's where people start trying to hone down to what issues are important to them. And I usually have done anywhere from 125 to 225 of these, depending upon the size of the city that I'm working in. And it's from there that you are able to spot leaders. You are able to hear the problems that people are talking about. And you are able to put together research committees that can take those problems and break them down into issues. And the word issue means to go forth. So to things that you can actually do. So if someone says education is a problem, you know, is a concern, I would say to them, well, that's a problem. What aspect of it is bothering you the most? Well, I don't like the fact that my child doesn't get enough time, you know, to play or in recess or whatever they're, you know, concerned about. And from all those meetings, you know, we gather them, people whittle them down to, you know, what we would start with. And that's how we begin. And by then you've been able to spot leaders. You've done research. People have done research on the issue that they're concerned about. And you're able to go forth.
So this practice, you know, this patient organizing practice that you have been doing for quite a few decades now, tell our listeners a little bit about where you've done this and the different places that this kind of work, you know, you've experienced.
Well, I've done this in various cities and states across the United States, from east to west and north to south. I did training on how to do this in South Africa before, when de Klerk was still the, you know, leader of an apartheid state. And we were in working with a group of Black South Africans and figuring out what they would work on once they got their freedom. I did this in the Labour Party off and on for 2 years in the UK. And I've done it with unions in Canada and in the United States. So it fits. How you apply it may be different, but it's the process is the same.
Possibly because it's speaking to some universals about the human condition, maybe.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, I call it a universal.
Yeah.
I think there are a number of universals that we in the Industrial Areas Foundation, you know, have, you know, brought forth. That means that they generally work in most places, except, you know, you have to apply it to the culture.
Of course. One of the things that makes, you know, the show's called Changemakers, right? And sometimes that phrase bristles people. Sometimes people love it. I'm not asking for judgment on the name. But what is interesting to me about the Industrial Areas Foundation, what is different about it, is who it thinks the changemakers need to be. And it lifts up the importance of leaders as central to making change. Talk to me a little bit about that as a centerpiece for the argument for organizing.
Well, the leadership in these in our organizations, the leadership is a collective, number one. It's not one person. It may be a collective of 15 to 20. And hopefully those 15 to 20 people represent the diversity of the organization that you are, you know, organizing. The organizer's role is to organize, and the leader's role is to lead. That is to say, it's not for the organizer to be talking to the media or the press. It's not for them to go on the television show. It's really not even for the organizer to speak at a big meeting. Almost never. I don't think I ever spoke at a large meeting. Your role is to develop a collective leadership that is able to strategize and work on the issues that have come out of all of those meetings that I was describing earlier.
Yeah.
And to teach. You're really a teacher, an agitator in the sense of getting people to act on their concerns. And you're a, you know, you're a teacher and a talent search. That's really the role of the organizer, to be, you know, teach, talent search, you know, that's develop leaders. That's by teaching, I mean, development of leaders. And that's the role of the organizer, as opposed to many organizations, which really the people who are putting the organization together are the leaders. So it's a different model.
Yeah.
In that sense.
So let's understand why you've chosen to dedicate your life to working with this different model. I'd love for you to, you know, take us back as far as you would like to and tell us some stories about why you became an organizer.
Wow. Well, it was, you know, really quite serendipitous for me. I came out of a working middle-income family. I went to a university that was a state school. And in the first year, very large, you know, maybe 40,000 students. And in my freshman year, my first year, I lived in a dormitory. And on the floor was an African-American fellow. At that time, there were very few African-American students. Out of 40,000, I think it's probably about 2%. And I'll try to do this quickly. We had a recreational basketball team where we played in a league. And we won the league. We went out to have a beer to celebrate. And the waitresses were not serving us. They kept walking by us. So I got up and said, I'll go to the bar and I'll bring back the beer. And the bartender kept walking by me as if I didn't exist. So I got up on the bar, leaning over, you know, and to block him, to get his attention. And I held out my arm and he stopped and he said, what do you want? And I said, 4 pitchers of beer. And he said, I'll serve you when you get rid of, then he used the N-word for African-American person. And I was stunned. I couldn't believe he would say that. I was naive. You know, I was 17. I hadn't been around very much. So I thought that I said to myself, he couldn't have said that. I knew enough to know that that was wrong. I said to myself, he must be saying Negro, because that was the terminology in the country that was used then. And so I got back up on the bar again, and he got very angry and he said, what do you want? And I said, then I got angry, it's 4 pitchers of beer. And then he used the N-word again. He started cussing and I started cussing at him, and I tried to take a swing at him. And these bouncers came and basically got a hold of me, two large guys, I'm small, and threw me out. And after that incident, no one would, on the floor where I lived, including the African-American guy, would talk to me, not even the African-American fellow. And so I just thought, well, I don't understand this stuff. I'll just get some friends and, you know, just stay on my own. And at the end of the semester, I went down to the cafeteria to have breakfast before an exam, and this African-American fellow was there. And so I went over because I knew I wouldn't see him again. It's a huge university. Once we graduated, you know, how would you see, you know, you're all scattered, different classes and so on. And so I had one more chance to see what, why didn't he never talk to me after that? And he told me that, did I really want to know? And I said, yeah, of course I want to know. And he said, well, okay, I'll tell you. I thought you were crazy. And I can't afford, you know, if the police came in, I'd be the one that was arrested. You know, he said to me, imagine if I had done that. I'm the one that's being insulted. He said it loud enough for me to hear, you know, him calling me, an N-word. But if I had done it, you did it, nothing happened to you. I mean, you got a little roughed up by the bouncers, but, you know, nothing happened to you. If I did it, they would have called the police and I would have been arrested for disorderly conduct. And then I would have been thrown out of school. And then I would have broken my parents' hearts because they worked two jobs each to save up money to send me to school. So I wouldn't be have to do what they were doing. They did, laboring work. And then he started explaining to me what life was like for him on the campus. And I was just stunned by it all. And it just stayed with me. And 2 years later, a couple of people, I was at a dance that was, sponsored by a civil rights group. And Congress of Racial Equality. I'd never heard of them. I didn't know anything about it. And they had said that they had been in the south of the country, in Mississippi, as a state in the south, and they had been sent to Buffalo, which is in the north, to organize a chapter because of racism, even though it's in the north. And people, the kids in the started, we want the music, we want the band back, this isn't Mississippi, But I knew differently from the experience I had had with this African-American fellow. His name was Vernon. I can remember it to this day. And so I wandered into the meeting. And from there, I just got absorbed and got involved in the civil rights movement. Lots of demonstrations, got arrested, badly treated by the police. People were threatening my life. My world turned upside down. But that's why I got involved, because I learned firsthand what Vernon's life was like on the college campus, and it was nothing like mine.
Yeah. The powerful thing is, though, as important as obviously as civil rights work was at that time, you didn't stay in that movement style of political activity. Talk to us about how you then shifted into community organizing.
Well, 5 or 6 years later, I was 2 years in Sierra Leone, West Africa, teaching in a small school and just teaching, not organizing. And then I came back to New York, where I'm from, and I was again teaching, but I was very disturbed by what was going on in the lack of money and attention being paid. It was a school of mainly Puerto Rican kids, and they were treated, very poorly. And so I was looking to get back in organizing, and I went to university to get a master's degree in what was called social work with community/community organizing. But I didn't learn really about organizing. I mean, I took courses, but it wasn't, theoretical. Within the 2 years, I spent 4 years in a very poor rural white area. And I was again in a movement. It was called the Welfare Rights Movement. People on welfare, they had no jobs, or their jobs paid so little that they had some supplement from the government. But they were mistreated, even though they were white. And so now I realize that this wasn't just a black problem. This was a power question. If you didn't have money, you didn't have much say so. And you had to take on whatever the government was giving or not giving you. And you had to deal with, being treated, as a lower class person. And so I was looking, before I graduated, I was looking for, some place to go where I could organize. And I was fortunate. I had a professor that knew Saul Alinsky, who was the founder of the Industrial Areas Foundation, and that's where she sent me. And I met with Ed Chambers, who was then the director, and he asked me what was my experience. It was an interview to get into the training session. And I told him all the things I had done. It may have been him, or I guess it was Alinsky that I was explaining this to. Sorry, it was Alinsky. And he said, young man, you sound like a pile of undigested actions. And I thought, wow, And through the training then, I realized that movements, I'd been in two movements, relied very heavily on the leader. And in Kentucky, the leader just sort of wore out. And then the organization seemed like it was lost. And in the civil rights movement, when the leaders were, you know, were gone, either they were killed or they, you know, just stopped being leaders. They couldn't take the pressure anymore. The whole organization was gone. So I thought there has to be a better way of doing this. And there need to be more leaders. Just because one person is gone, you know, as tragic as that is, it doesn't mean that the whole effort should be gone. It's not about a person. And so that's how I moved into community organizing, which is a collective leadership, not an individual. And it's not a movement. It's not around one thing. It's around a set of things which try to bring in the interest of a variety of people and not just one problem. Yeah. Like civil rights or payments that go to poor people.
So Saul Alinsky agitated you and helped you affirm some of the things that you were already thinking about, the role of leaders and the need to deal with the power problem mm-hmm. you were confronting. But you have made this piece of work your life's work. You know, you've been involved in community organizing in different places since then. Why did you stay? Why is this the place that you wanted to be for your career?
Well, right, I stayed. I did it for 45 years. I just, there were a couple of things. On the personal side, I just kept growing. I felt like I was learning and growing all the time. I was in different cities. I was in metropolitan areas. You know, I was in England. I was in South Africa. I just felt like I was in Canada, unions, community organizations. I just felt like where else would I grow like this? Where else would I be exposed in real time with people struggling, you know, to make a better, you know, world, better community anyway? And I never cared for school because it felt remote to me. Especially in graduate school, teaching about community organizing instead of doing it felt remote to me. This was on the ground, you know, and I was meeting, in organizing, I was meeting all kinds of people, you know, from very poor people to, you know, upper middle class people, from, you know, Latinx and Hispanic people to African American people to Asian American people to white people, to people who were religious, to people who weren't religious. And I just felt like it was the most fascinating kind of life. And I met so many interesting people, you know, along the way that challenged me to grow and challenged me in my thinking. And the other thing was I had a fair amount of anger and about, you know, what I see around me. And I had to figure out a constructive place to put it, not just yelling at a bartender and getting into a fight with two bouncers. I mean, that when you're small like me, it's not a good idea. I had to find some constructive place to put that, make it work for me, not just temper, but really make the anger, you know, like cold anger, like when you put how you make steel. I wanted to be like that and get some discipline. So between accomplishing things, which is winning sometimes, which was always great, meeting a vast array of people, all from different walks of life, and trying to knit them together, and having a constructive place to put what I felt was, you know, my anger, what was wrong with things, it just was a great life for me.
So much so, Arnie, that you've written a book, Lessons Learned, about all the things that you, all the insights and sort of principles, as well as the stories, some of the highlight stories that you gathered across your 45 years of being an organizer. And, you know, to our listeners, I would say, go get the book, right? It's a great book. There's heaps and heaps of extraordinary stories in it. And I'm just going to pick up on a couple, right? A couple of things sure. that we can talk about. Yeah, the first thing that struck me was, you know, how you talk in several stories about in the lead up to when the major achievement was gained, when the victory was gained, that the opposition organized your people, that the opposition did something that brought people together in a way in which possibly the organization itself might not have been able to. And so that's not always how good strategic planning is conceived in many progressive movements. People think of writing a strategy that is self-proclaimed rather than one that is, you know, in tension with oppositions or dialectical, if you want to get into a fancy word. Tell us, you know, when you think about this idea of the importance and the role of the opposition in strategy and their actions and how that can actually galvanize your people, tell us about how that, how a community organizer thinks about strategy, knowing that that is something that can happen.
Well, say to the other side does a lot of the organizing for you, because it's in their reaction to what you are doing that they expose themselves or they say things which lead you to, you know, an insight into an issue. You do an action, we call it an action instead of a demonstration, because a demonstration is just what, you know, it's, you're demonstrating. Many of you have small children. They demonstrate a lot. We had four children. We had a lot of demonstrations in our house. An action is aimed for a specific purpose, which is to get a specific reaction if you're able to get that. But that's what you're planning for. I can say to a group of people in the community, you know, corporate America is doing this or that, and they'll, you know, shake their head. Yeah, right, sure, you know, what's new, something like that. But if they sit down with the chief executive, if I can get them into a meeting with the chief, you know, or the organization get us into a meeting with the chief executive officer of a corporation that is either discriminating against people of color or is refusing to pay a decent wage, if you can get that person to react in a way that exposes himself, usually to him as a CEO, but he exposes himself, then it's real to people. You know, it's, they've seen it in real time, and it isn't some, you know, nebulous corporate leader. This is, you know, Mr. Jones face to face with the leadership of your organization, and hopefully you've gotten him to say certain things which open up for people what really is going on, and they can it's hard to focus on a corporation. You can only focus on a person. You know, when you generally say corporations do this or that, yeah, but who's making that decision? And how do people get to understand, you know, how you might be able to create some change? So you plan to try, you research as much as you can about the person that you're meeting with and about the company. If it's not a politician, let's say we're talking about a corporation, and you work as hard as you can, you know, in the planning to figure out where this person might react. What you do or what you say might bring a reaction. Not, I mean, like, you know, cussing at him, you know, you rich son of a, you know, not that kind of reaction, but a reaction that reveals something or puts him on the spot in a way that he feels he has to either lie to you and then you can catch him in the lie, or, you know, he just tries to cover up, or, you know, or he responds well.
Have you got a favorite reaction?
Oh, gosh. Well, I write in the book, in the effort around trying to get decent wages in San Antonio, Texas, which is a big city in Texas, about the ninth biggest city in the country. It's a majority Mexican-American, you know, the majority of the poor. And the corporate community there, since the 1930s, we found out, had banded together to not let any good paying factories in. And they didn't want unions. So it was all low wage companies that were there. And when we found this out in a report, there was a report, and we were able to find out, somebody came to us and told us about this report. We'd never heard of it, where it was laid out. The strategy was in print that We didn't want to bring in any, you know, we weren't going to recruit. They weren't going to recruit any companies that paid well so they could keep the wages low in the city. And after a lot of tense actions, we got the head of a very large insurance company, USAA, and three other corporate leaders to sit down with four leaders and myself. And we, you know, we had to get a reaction out of the head guy who was military and, you know, very officious and non-responsive to react to what we had. And we went at him in a way in which he finally, you know, reacted. And he called us a bunch of communists and all kinds of foolish stuff. And it became evident to me that he was just saying whatever, you know, stereotype he thought he had. But he was saying this to one of the leaders was a priest, and two others of the people on his team were Catholic. And the priest objected to be calling, you know, to be called a communist, and quoted some things from the Bible. I don't remember whether Isaiah or Jeremiah or something, as to why he was a priest and what he was doing, and where were they in their belief system, and what was wrong with them, Catholic or not Catholic. And it just kind of stunned General McDermott. He'd never been spoken to a priest like that. And he tried to defend himself, and then, you know, then we knew we kind of had him.
So much intentionality in the negotiation with those who have power. And part of this idea of planning for the reaction is planning for changing the dynamic of power face to face.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Probably the most distinctive and powerful part of one of the very distinctive and powerful parts of organizing is its focus on negotiation rather than just demonstration, like the intentionality
right.
of changing people's minds through the presentation of power, but then the negotiation of interest.
Right.
So one of the other very interesting things that you've done, Arnie, very interesting life, but I think that I'm interested in, is that you explicitly sought to translate organizing to other contexts, and particularly to the context of a political party. Now, I can only imagine that at the time, for some, this would have been heresy. You know, the Industrial mm-hmm. Areas Foundation is a nonpartisan organization, and this was an act of not being partisan, being explicitly partisan. And you worked for several years inside the Labour Party of the United Kingdom. Tell us a little about what did you learn? Was it transferable, or how much was and how much wasn't transferable to that context? And any insights you have about that?
Yeah, well, because we are Industrial Areas Foundation, nonpartisan, I had to, and I was a co-executive director, I had to step down from that so we wouldn't get in tax problems, with the United States government. I originally started going over there. It was just to do... Ed Miliband was then the leader of the Labour Party, and it was just to do a sort of, they call it a root and branch. I don't know, just move around in a certain area and give him what I thought I saw. And it was a 10-week trip. And there was a couple of people who I knew that asked me to do this, and I met with him, and he wanted me to do it. You know, we got on okay. So I did it, and I laid out to him what I saw, taking into account that who can understand a country in 10 weeks. I told him, I'm no expert here. But there were a few things that seemed to me to be evident, and some of it he would already know. The most boring time and the worst times I had in that trip, which was a great trip, was going to a Labour Party meeting.
That's universal. Sorry.
They were boring. They were like, you know, a bunch of older people sitting around, or sometimes, you know, good people, but some all were good people, but, you know, some, you know, progressives, and they were going to, you know, change the country, you know, in a massive way. And, you know, and this is what we needed to do. And it was fine, except it wasn't rooted in any reality, you know. And so I told them, you know, for one, you know, the leadership is at that time, you know, was in the local communities were old. And two, the younger people were, you know, good people and wanted to do good things, but they're out to change, you know, the entire country. And, you know, they weren't the party in power. So, and they wanted to put together some demonstrations and things. And I just listened because I was just, you know, trying to figure out and then write back what was going on. I realized that the staff, that many, you know, staff didn't know much about organizing. Organizing was door knocking to them for the most part. Not everyone, but mostly was door knocking. And because every 5-year cycle there in the UK, you know, for an election, a national election, there were 4 elections within that 5-year cycle. It was a local election, countywide election, you know, all kinds of elections. And in each election, there was door knocking. And the organizers, people who were called organizers, had the title, were basically door knockers. And people, and they were people who tried to recruit other people to door knock. And at that time, I think it's changed some, most of the door knockers, which were maybe 6 or 7 people, were fairly elderly people. I mean, they're well enough to walk up and down the street, but, and I listened in on the door knocking and I, you know, realized that they were just selling the Labour Party. You know, they were trying to find out on a scale of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, where are they on the party? You know, 1 being very strong for the party, being 5, they're not interested at all. And so they were trying to get down the street real fast. And so these conversations were brief, 30 to 60 second. I'll call them a conversation. They were 30 seconds where the person was trying to see if the person was a 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. So I realized there wasn't any real organizing going on. The party was old. It wasn't very creative. It was doing everything it had done the same way for the last gosh knows how many years. And people were frustrated and, you know, that was basically what I was saying to him. And he said to me, well, you know, that's, you know, probably the way it is. I'm sure, but, you know, what would you do about it? I said, well, it's only 10 weeks. And it's a whole country. Entire country, you know, Labour Party, not just local, you know, nationally. But I said, you know, maybe you could listen, you know, a little bit. These door knocking sessions are not listening to people, and trying to drag people into these monthly Labour Party meetings is like death. You know, I can hardly stand sitting through them. And so it seems to me that, you know, you make your decisions from the top to the bottom, because there aren't that many people involved. There's probably 40, 50 people in the national party that make the decisions. Instead of from the bottom up, you assume you know what people want and how they are, but you don't really know that. And so he said, well, that's, you know, it's a tough, you know, that's probably right, but it's a tough analysis. And then he asked me if I would do training there. And so that's when I stepped down from the IIF and I thought, well, let me try this. I never worked with a political party. I never had the head of a party tell me, why don't we try this? You know? So I did a lot of training on organizing, basic things, how to do an individual meeting, you know, how to run a small meeting so that it's everybody gets in and it's interesting, how to take a problem and break it down into an issue. That is, if, you know, take something that people say, you know, it's very large and try to break it down into something they can do about it. Just some basic, as we talked about before, universals. And the reactions I was getting were great. And I really started enjoying this. I was in another place, another culture, but once this was going on, it just seemed, you know, people were engaged and hungry for it. So then Ed Miliband asked me to stay on, you know, what the year was at. He asked me to stay on again, but would I, you know, all this was good, but how would I apply it to an election? You know, because we're not a training institute, we're a political party. And so I took an area where Lancashire County, which is the largest independent county for election purposes. And it was a county election and there are 86 seats. It had always been Labour. It was in the north of the country. But David Cameron won it. When he won, the whole county council changed from Labour to Tory. Labour went from controlling 48 seats down to 17. I mean, they took a beating. And I picked this area because the regional director, a woman named Anna Hutchinson, was just great, you know, willing to try anything. You know, she said, if we're down to 17, what do we have to lose, you know, in a way. And her husband was the, quote, organizer. And he was good. He was open. And he knew a lot of people in the communities. And we got together a team of 10 people and trained them on basic individual meetings and organizing to get them to bring six people over 10 weeks. That's bring six people to a meeting where we would begin a process of house meetings and getting to the issues that they cared about, not what the national government told them was important. And I had gotten permission from Ed Miliband for the national to stay out of it. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. You have to stop telling people what they care about instead of listening to them. And he said, okay, let's try it. It's an experiment. You know, it's in one place. I remember saying something like, how much worse could we do than, you know, being down to 17 seats out of 86 seats? So we trained the people, the 10, and sure enough, when we came together for the meeting, I remember these numbers because there were 103 people there. It should have been 60, 10 people doing six meetings, and you wouldn't expect all of them to come. And there was energy in the room, and they had been recruited by 10 people leaders that, you know, I had worked with and trained on how to do individual meetings and so forth. And the meeting was great. We had 10, we broke the meeting down into 10 smaller meetings, 10 people around a table who never had met with each other or talked with each other. Some were not even part of the party. And we came up with an agenda that we whittled down to five things because over there, they would have an agenda that they wanted. I'm serious. It could be 55 different things.
Oh, God.
And not ranked. I mean, they were all. So when you're talking to people, you're talking about you're giving them your agenda. It was crazy, you know. So they had five things, and then we began, you know, working on this is what we would do if we won around these five things. And we had some more training sessions, and then we eventually wound up. This was over about an 8-month period of time. We wound up with 400 people door knocking during the week on an average, and 200 during the week and 400 on the weekends. And the energy was great. And we won back the council.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, this is fantastic. You know, we went from 17 seats to 39 seats. And that meant we just had to put a coalition together get four more other people, which we did on the council. And it was run by Labour. Jenny was the leader of it. It was great. And Ed was excited and everybody was excited. And when it came time for the general election, they had two people who were going to run the national campaign who just didn't believe in this process and didn't think, you know, it could work across the whole country. And I agreed, you know, I mean, you couldn't do this within a year's time, but would they allow me to take 10 marginal seats and work with them? And let's see what happens. And then you could compare it as to what happened, you know, in the rest of the country. And you weren't expecting to win these seats anyway, so why not try it? And because of a lot of politics and party politics and all of that, Ed never, you know, agreed to it. As the people he brought in to run the national campaign didn't want that, even if it was just 10 seats out of, you know, I forget how many seats there are, you know, hundreds.
Did that experience, I mean, I look at that and go, do you think that that's always going to happen with political parties, that there's always going to be that limit or roof? Or do you think that in under different circumstances, different leadership, different whatever, that it could have been, that actually that could have been different?
Well, it could have been different, but I don't know if national, you know, political parties, I mean, I got to know the inside of it. And I'm saying that Labour Party is like every other party, so I'm just speaking from that experience and from some knowledge of the Democratic Party, not that I ever worked for them, but I know people, you know, in the Democratic Party in the United States, they have a certain way of doing things. They are invested in that way of doing it, and it's very hard to break through. You know, in the Democratic Party now, there isn't much work that goes on in between elections. And then they raise a huge amount of money and bombard people with, you know, they don't talk to them door to door anymore. I mean, they bombard them with, you know, through the internet and all kinds of messaging and lots of money in advertising. And, you know, I don't think they really sit and talk with people. So, and it's hard to change the dynamic, you know, because there are people who have power in those parties and have vested interests in doing things the way they feel it needs to be done and to get themselves into positions. And it's very hard to break through that. I mean, the Labour Party, you know, I just couldn't get Ed to agree to just let me take 10 seats, which you're probably going to lose anyway. But let me see what we can do. I mean, we have this experience in Lancashire, which is interesting, at least. And he kept promising, you know, that this is going to happen. And then someone from the Labour Party leaked to the Conservatives and to the Murdoch papers that I was an illegal immigrant.
Wow.
Which I'd been working there for 2 years. I was an illegal immigrant. And it came up on all front pages of all the Murdoch papers. Ed's guru is an illegal immigrant. And pictures of me and him, you know, shaking hands or something like that. And I wasn't. I mean, I had all the right papers. But that, you know, immigration was a big issue and illegal immigrants. And it ran for 2-3 days, you know, in page 2, page 3. You know, Ed kept saying to me, well, you know, it's not true. So our lawyers will clear this up. And he never really pushed it all the way because there was so much heat around it, you know, for about a month. And then it just, you know, sort of disappeared. But I was out of the country.
In every action, there's a reaction. And sometimes...
That's right.
It's not always what we hope.
You got it. That's it. You got it. That's absolutely right.
God. Well...
So I don't know what you can do in political parties. I don't know.
Yeah, I reckon it's an interesting question mark, a provocation to be raised now, because what you're describing in the UK Labour Party, I don't doubt for anyone who's familiar with the Australian Labour Party would be going, oh, yes, I can imagine some of those difficulties that are here. And I imagine it could be better if there was more of this kind of organising culture in it. But whether it's possible to make that change here in Canada, in the US, it'll be interesting to see what happens. But I just want to say thank you for this amazing conversation. For our listeners who are interested in what we've discussed here, you should read Lessons Learned. It's got these stories writ large with lots of detail and also explanation around some of these fascinating organizing concepts mixed into those stories, which is not often done. People can tell good stories, but they don't necessarily have useful principles, applicable principles about what you can take away. So, Arnie, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, Amanda.
So did I. What a blessing. Thank you.
Be well.
Thanks.
Changemakers is hosted by me, Amanda Tattersall. Remember to subscribe to the podcast to catch all our episodes. And don't forget the back catalogue filled with stories and chats with wonderful people. Changemakers is produced by Xander Shivani. Our audio producer is Jules Bookerer. Our series sponsor is the Sydney Policy Lab at the University of Sydney. They break down barriers between researchers, policymakers, and community campaigners so we can build change together. Check them out at sydney.edu.au/policy-lab. Like us on Facebook at Changemakers Podcast, and check out changemakerspodcast.org for transcripts and updates on all of our stories. We also run a fabulous Facebook chat group, Changemaker Chats, on Facebook. Search it up, my friends, where you can meet and exchange ideas with other listeners. And don't forget to take a look at our organising school if you want to take a deeper dive into the art of changemaking.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.